From
NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A grand jury in Cincinnati has indicted a white police officer on two misdemeanor charges in the killing of an unarmed black teenager. Officer Stephen Roach was charged with negligent homicide and obstructing official business in the shooting death of 19-year-old Timothy Thomas. Roach killed Thomas with a single shot as Thomas fled down a dark alley. Prosecutor Michael Allen said the grand jury chose not to recommend more severe charges.
Murder is not appropriate in this case because murder is a purposeful act, and it requires a specific intention to cause a certain result. And I can only surmise that the grand jury felt that that was not appropriate in this case.
The shooting triggered three nights of rioting in Cincinnati, and some activists have said that anything less than felony charges against Roach would spark more community anger. The Texas Senate has passed a bill named for hate crime victim James Byrd, Jr. Byrd was the black man killed in 1998 after being dragged behind a pickup truck. Janet Heimlich reports from Austin.
The Senate passed the hate crimes bill on a 20-10 vote with one member absent. The bill would increase penalties for crimes motivated by hate against a person because of factors like race, religion, and sexual preference. Supporters have had a tough time getting the bill passed. While Texas already has a hate crimes law, it does not mention specific groups to be protected. Some conservatives have opposed mentioning gays. When President George W. Bush was governor, he opposed the bill. In response to the bill's passage, Republican Governor Rick Perry expressed his support but would not commit to signing the bill. He said he had wanted to see legislation approved that would give all Texans the same protection, not just those groups mentioned. The bill now goes to the House, which passed it last session. For NPR News, I'm Janet Heimlich in Austin.
President Bush said today that America has suffered because the president has limited authority in negotiating new trade deals with other nations. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
It was anger over the North American Free Trade Agreement by labor unions as well as environmental and human rights groups that prompted Congress to deny President Clinton's so-called fast-track authority to negotiate trade deals. Now President Bush, having set the goal of expanding NAFTA to cover the entire Western Hemisphere, says he needs that trade authority restored because U.S. progress on trade has stalled.
Free trade agreements are being negotiated all over the world, and we're not a party to them. And this has got to change.
The president will send to Congress this week his formal request to have what is now called trade promotion authority, under which the president could negotiate trade agreements. Congress could then approve or reject them, but could not modify them. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 16 points to close at 10,935. The NASDAQ lost 18. This is NPR News. A delegation from the European Union has flown to Chechnya on a fact-finding mission. Their visit comes amid an upsurge in violence in the war-torn region. Eric Engelman reports from Moscow.
The delegates began at a refugee camp in Ingushetia, the Russian Republic bordering Chechnya, and promised to keep up deliveries of humanitarian aid. Hundreds of thousands of Chechens are living there in squalid conditions, afraid to return home because of continued fighting. The EU group then moved on to Chechnya itself, even as reports emerged of skirmishes between Russian forces and rebel fighters. High-profile visits like this one have proven an embarrassment for the Russian government, which likes to portray the war as over and the situation in Chechnya as calm. One of the EU delegates, Swedish Ambassador Sven Herdman, said his team has evidence of serious human rights abuses in Chechnya. The team is to deliver its report at an EU-Russia summit on May 17th. For NPR News, this is Eric Engelman in Moscow.
Palestinian officials said a baby girl was killed and 24 other Palestinians were hurt today when Israeli soldiers shelled their home in a refugee camp in the Gaza Strip. 10 children were among the injured. Israeli troops said they thought the houses they fired at were abandoned. They said they were responding to an attack by Palestinian militants who fired mortar shells at two Jewish settlements in Gaza. Palestinian authorities say there was no mortar attack from their side. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon said today that he was sorry for the death of the four-month-old baby, but he said Israel will continue to fight against terrorism. In stocks, the S&P 500 lost 3 points today to close at 1,263. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, maker of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, The Nature of What's to Come, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Colin Firth, is now starring opposite Renee Zellweger in the film Bridget Jones's Diary. Author Helen Fielding wanted him for the part. In her novel, which the film is based on, Bridget develops a crush on Firth as she watches him star in the BBC adaptation of Pride and Prejudice in the role of Mr. Darcy. Firth's character in Bridget Jones, Mark Darcy, is an homage to Firth's performance in Pride and Prejudice. Pride and Prejudice made Firth an unlikely heartthrob in England and in parts of America as well when the adaptation was shown on A&E. Firth also co-starred in The English Patient as the spurned husband and in Shakespeare in Love as the unwanted fiancé Lord Wessex. He starred as an obsessed soccer fan in the film adaptation of Nick Hornby's novel Fever Pitch. Let's start with a scene from Bridget Jones's Diary. Bridget has overheard Mark Darcy making sarcastic comments about her, and it's played on her insecurities and made her angry.
I mean, you seem to go out of your way to try to make me feel like a complete idiot every time I see you. And you really needn't bother. I already feel like an idiot most of the time anyway. With or without a fireman's pole.
Look, I'm sorry if I've been...
What?
I don't think you're an idiot at all. I mean, there are elements of the ridiculous about you. Your mother's pretty interesting. And you really are an appallingly bad public speaker. And you tend to let whatever's in your head come out of your mouth without much consideration of the consequences. I realized that when I met you at the turkey curry buffet that I was unforgivably rude and wearing a reindeer jumper that my mother had given me the day before. But the thing is, what I'm trying to say very inarticulately is that, in fact, perhaps despite appearances, I like you very much.
Apart from the smoking and the drinking and the vulgar mother and the verbal diarrhea.
No, I like you very much, just as you are.
Colin Firth, welcome to Fresh Air. In a lot of your earlier interviews, you talk about how you really wanted to put Mr. Darcy in Pride and Prejudice behind you. So what was your reaction when Helen Fielding asked you to play a part that was an homage to your portrayal of Darcy in Pride and Prejudice, thus continuing continuing the whole thing?
I suppose I did it in the spirit of if you can't beat them, join them. I wasn't strenuously trying to put it behind me. I think this creation, impression has been created to some extent. And, you know, I found that the Darcy tag didn't really touch me unless I was speaking to a journalist. So it really wasn't something that was disturbing me. If there was any curse on it at all, I felt somehow instinctively that doing this other thing called Mr. Darcy, I don't know, there was some bizarre negative psychology attached to it, but I felt it might take that curse off. And in fact, it's been very interesting seeing my name being used, my actual name being used in articles now rather than the Darcy name. So I think at the moment, to some extent, it seems to have worked.
What was your reaction when The Diary of Bridget Jones was published, knowing that the character in the book had a crush on you?
Well, that's you can't not be enormously flattered to start with, you know, to have made it into fiction, into popular fiction, feels like quite an achievement. In fact, it's one of the biggest accolades I think modern society can accord you, is that you have now become, you know, part of the general canon of popular reference points, and it was delightful. It didn't happen suddenly because this thing had been growing as a diary column for some time. But I was absolutely thrilled. I felt immortalized.
No, Pride and Prejudice is set in an earlier century. Your language and attire are more formal. I'm going to ask you to compare your acting style in each film, you know, like a literary adaptation versus a contemporary comedy. But first, let's hear a scene from Pride and Prejudice. And in this scene, you first confess your love to the character of Elizabeth Bennet, played by Jennifer Ely.
In vain I have struggled. It will not do. My feelings will not be repressed. You must allow me to tell you how ardently I admire and love you. In declaring myself thus, I am fully aware that I will be going expressly against the wishes of my family, my friends, and I hardly need add my own better judgment. The relative situation of our families is such that any alliance between us must be regarded as a highly reprehensible connection. Indeed, as a rational man, I cannot but regard it as such myself, but it cannot be helped. Almost from the earliest moments of our acquaintance, I have come to feel for you a passionate admiration and regard, which, despite all my struggles, has overcome every rational objection, and I beg you most fervently to relieve my suffering and consent to be my wife.
In such cases as these, I believe the established mode is to express a sense of obligation. But I cannot. I have never desired your good opinion, and you have certainly bestowed it most unwillingly. I'm sorry to cause pain to anyone, but it was most unconsciously done, and I hope will be of short duration.
And this is all the reply I am to expect. I might wonder why, with so little effort and civility, I am rejected.
And I might wonder why, with so evident a desire to offend and insult me, you chose to tell me that you liked me against your will, against your reason, and even against your character. Was this not some excuse for incivility if I was uncivil?
Let me ask you to compare your approach to contemporary romantic comedy, Bridget Jones, and dramatic literary adaptation, Pride and Prejudice. You can talk about your physical carriage, your accent, the speed you speak at. I mean, the speech is so much more formal in Pride and Prejudice.
It is. I think one just somehow instinctively adapts to the requirements. You can't say, can I have a light in a formal Victorian way? You can't say, allow me to tell you how ardently I admire and love you very easily in a kind of Bronx accent or a Cockney accent of the year 2001. So I think as an actor, it's essential that you're sensitive to language, and I think that the language actually informs the rest of it. I think that I certainly find that this is my starting point. My walk can change because of the way I speak, and then the way I speak will be informed by the rhythms on the page. So it's a process which happens, I think, without much calculation. I think the Bridget Jones Pride and Prejudice case is quite a singular one, I think, because Mark Darcy is, in fact, very much a fugitive, I think, from another century. I mean, I think this is part of his problem. Mr. Darcy is very much a man of his time. He's isolated by other factors, but Mark Darcy, I think, is not typical. He's not certainly not typical of the Englishman of his age that I know. And I think that he comes from a rather archaic family, and I think that he's someone whose personality is crippling him in some way.
I'm wondering how the clothes affect you. Like in Pride and Prejudice, you're wearing frilled high-collared shirts, and in Bridget Jones, in the first scene that you appear in, your mother just gave you a really silly sweater with a large moose head on it. And
yeah. They affect you enormously. I had a bit more of a challenge with Mark Darcy, because I had to put on a ridiculous sweater with a moose head on it and pretend that I was standing in a frilly shirt and a frock coat. So I couldn't allow that costume to dictate the way I was holding myself. I had to play against the clothes in that case, and that therein lay the comic gag.
Just a question about your most famous scene from Pride and Prejudice. It's the famous pond scene. At the end of the story, you take off your jacket, and with your shirt and pants on, you dive into a pond. And although it sounds pretty inhibited to dive in with shirt and pants, for your character, it's a sign of feeling more liberated and expressive. Mm. When you walk out of the pond with your wet clothes clinging to you, you became a heartthrob. Did you understand that?
Not really. It was so... That happened as a series of haphazard decisions. I mean, it was almost an accident, really, that led to the whole wet shirt business. And I think probably if anyone had connived at a a phenomenon like that. They would have failed miserably. If I remember the original script, it was had it down that Darcy dives in completely naked, and I suppose he might well have done that. He's on his own property, and it's a hot day. But the BBC didn't consider that acceptable. And then there was some talk of underwear, and then we heard that nobody wore underwear in those days. And I think there was an attempt to create underwear. The kind of, if they had worn underwear, would they have looked like this? And I went to be fitted with those, and there was no way on earth. And I can tell you now, had I worn those, there would have been no heartthrob.
What was this underwear looking like?
They were kind of knee breeches. I think they were cotton or silk. They looked like sailors pants or something from pirate. I can't remember very well, but they came down just below the knee and
little pantaloony kind of things.
Yeah, not flattering.
Uh-huh.
And so in the end, I thought, well, what's second most spontaneous to taking all your clothes off and diving into a pond? I suppose really not taking any of them off, really. Maybe just jump in. And which is basically how I tried to play it. It's the jacket comes off and the vest comes off. Well, he just sort of sits there and thinks for a minute and then in he goes. No way does anybody think that is going to start to, that's going to become a famously remembered image.
Did it affect your career in a positive way?
I don't know. I really don't know. It's so hard to quantify these things. I think it must have done. I think that everything you do, I suppose, takes you in one direction or another, and I can't see that it would have been negative. I suppose I have an inclination. I've always, as an actor, had an inclination towards playing unhappy people, people who might be considered society's losers, and people who are unattractive. I tend to find that work as an actor far more interesting. And playing Mr. Darcy kind of took me a little bit further away from that. And I think there was a slight misreading of what kind of actor I was as a result of that. I think there was a feeling that this meant that perhaps I really was a romantic leading man, when I'm not, actually. I'm a character actor. And I think that's been confused because of this fairly neutral appearance that I have. But it was interpreted as a leading man performance, and it wasn't. Mr. Darcy was absolutely a piece of character work.
In two of your romantic comedies, you were in fight scenes. In Shakespeare in Love, you're the man Gwyneth Paltrow is supposed to marry but doesn't want to, and you'll duel with the man she's really in love with. In Bridget Jones, you have a fist fight with Hugh Grant, who's your romantic rival for Bridget's affections. What's the difference, do you think, between fighting in a comedy and fighting in a drama?
Usually, comedy is considered, in some ways, a more difficult form. It's considered the more serious form. Drama, you have to be disciplined for it. You put all your intensity behind it. You think, kill, you think whatever. I think these things may be things you have to work for and are not that easily attained, but they're certainly not that complicated. I think with comedy they are, because you've got to find an absurdity somewhere in it without looking as if you're trying to be funny. I think that the minute any comic actor looks as if they're asking for a laugh, they won't get one. I think that Hugh and I both had a very strong natural sense of the absurd. I think it was hopefully our own self-mockery that produced that fight. We didn't work very hard on it. We just thought, how would we fight? It's embarrassing to admit it, but that's probably exactly how Hugh Grant and I would fight if it came to that.
My guest is Colin Firth. He's now starring in the film Bridget Jones's Diary. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Colin Firth is joining us if you're just tuning in, and he's now starring in Bridget Jones' Diary. Let me ask you about your coming of age. I know your parents were both academics. Were they college teachers?
Yes. Yeah. They're still doing it now. They endlessly study and teach various courses, and they're just relentlessly curious people.
And your grandparents were missionaries in India, I believe?
That's right, yeah.
What denomination were they?
I think that changed through the years. My mother's parents were both Congregationalist ministers. That's my grandmother as well. She was ordained in the 1930s, and when it was not that conventional in any church. And my father's father, in the end, was an Anglican minister. All three of them, I should say, belonged to the Church of South India for a while. My maternal grandfather rebelled against the Church of South India over certain things, and I think that's when he went Congregationalist. He became a doctor, in fact. I think he went out there as a church missionary. This is my maternal grandfather, and at the age of 38, he decided that he would be of better use in that country as a doctor. So he decided to get a medical training. The only country in the world that would train a man of that age was the United States. So he took his family to the United States and went through medical school in Iowa for 7 years, and then went back to India and set up practice there in osteopathic medicine.
Did your parents practice religion, and did you grow up in a religious household?
Yes, I think the word religion was always treated with a little bit of caution in my household. The short answer is definitely yes. My mother's interest has always been very much in alternative, comparative religions. She's very pantheistic. She has a lot of mystical interests, and the subject of her fairly recent PhD was death and bereavement in a Gujarati community in Southampton, for which she learnt Hindi. But she takes an enormous interest in a large variety of religions and tends to see merit in all of them. My father he keeps it much more close to his chest. I think it's something very personal to him.
So one more thing about religion. When you were growing up, did you find this kind of cross-cultural exposure to religion interesting or too kooky for you?
No, I found it fascinating. I mean, it was there from the start. It was never kooky to me. In fact, I found it much more difficult to adapt, I think, to a school environment where I was listening to prejudices against those sorts of things. My first 4 years of my life were in Nigeria. Not that one remembers a lot about the first 4 years of one's life, but it did make an impression on me, not least because people we'd known there continued to be in our lives as visitors. And there were constantly people from India. Both my parents were born and raised in India. And so there was an immense cultural diversity under my own roof throughout my entire upbringing. And I consider that to be absolutely nothing but a privilege. And so, and it, to me, I suppose it was the norm. And so I found any kind of racist remarks or any kind of religious prejudices among my own peers very, very difficult to take.
What brought your parents to Nigeria?
My father was teaching. It was just curiosity. He took an overseas teaching post in his job as a history teacher in the equivalent of a high school.
And where else did you live when you were growing up?
Well, mostly around England after that. We came back and we travelled around the English provinces. Well, my father took a job in another school, a high school level, for 3 or 4 years, and then a college. And so that led to two or three moves, I think. And then we were a year in the United States, in St. Louis. I was in junior high. And then back to England. And so most of my upbringing has taken place in England.
Junior high is a tough time to change environments because I think most junior high school students have so many hormones raging out of control that they don't know what they're doing and often do really inappropriate things. And it's a tough period. Was it a tough time for you?
I've been bumped up a year because the English start school a year earlier than the Americans. We go into first grade, the equivalent of first grade, when Americans go into kindergarten. So the reasoning was that I should be put in a class of kids a year older than me. And there was a bit of a shock attached to that because I was, I was an elementary, what we call a primary school boy. And I found the kids around me at this high school much, much more sophisticated. So it was a difficult adjustment to make. I have to say, though, that some of the teaching I had that year is the best teaching I've ever had. I still remember very clearly my English teacher, my history teacher, my science teacher. And I sometimes look back over my school years and wonder if I really learned anything at all. But I do look over that year, and despite the fact that it was a mixed experience, it's one of the only years I can single out as having specifically remembered what I learned.
Colin Firth is starring in the film Bridget Jones's Diary. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Random House Incorporated's Dell Trade Paperback Division, publisher of The Greatest Generation by Tom Brokaw, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The rare original cast recording of the 1943 revival of Rodgers and Hart's A Connecticut Yankee was just reissued. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz has a review. And we continue our conversation with actor Colin Firth. He'll read an excerpt of his short story just published by Nick Hornby. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with actor Colin Firth. He's now starring opposite Renee Zellweger in the film Bridget Jones's Diary. He also co-starred in Shakespeare in Love and The English Patient. Now Firth has a short story published in a new collection edited by the British writer Nick Hornby, who's best known for the novel High Fidelity, which was adapted into a film. Firth starred in the adaptation of Hornby's earlier novel, Fever Pitch. Firth played Paul, an English teacher and high school soccer coach who's obsessed with soccer, or football as it's known in England. He's particularly obsessed with the team Arsenal, which he's loved since his childhood. For the first time in 18 years, his team has a chance to win the Football League Championship, but it's falling behind. Paul's girlfriend, Sarah, played by Ruth Gemmell, is a serious-minded teacher who has a hard time understanding Paul's obsession. In this scene, she's come to tell him he didn't get a promotion at the school where they both teach. Paul is depressed about the game.
Do you understand what today meant to me? Do you know how long I've been waiting for this?
Yes, I do, actually. 18 years.
Yeah, 18 years! 18 years! I wanted Arsenal to win the league longer than I wanted to do anything. And after that stupid little end-of-year job, for about 2 weeks, do you honestly think I'd care about that more?
No, of course not. No, I know that you care more about whether one team scores more than another team at a football match. You really thought I came here to comfort you about that?
Did for a moment, yeah. Credited you with some imagination. I honestly thought you might understand how I was feeling.
Paul, it's only a game.
Don't say that! Please! That is the worst, most stupid thing anyone could say. But it quite clearly isn't only a game. I mean, if it was, do you honestly think I'd care this much? Hey? 18 years! 18 years! Do you know what you wanted 18 years ago? Or 10? Or 5? Do you want to be head of year at a North London comprehensive? I doubt it. Doubt if you'd wanted anything for that long. And if you had, and if you'd spent 3 months thinking that finally you were going to get it, and just when you think it's there, it's taken away from you. I mean, I don't care what it is, a car, a job, an Oscar, the baby. Then you'd understand how I was feeling tonight. But there isn't, and you don't, so.
Colin Firth in a scene from the film adaptation of Nick Hornby's novel Fever Pitch. I asked Colin Firth to read an excerpt of the short story he wrote, which is included in the new collection Speaking with the Angel, edited by Nick Hornby. The story is from the point of view of an 11-year-old boy whose grandmother is sick, disoriented, and probably dying.
When I got home the next day, Mum and Dad were arguing about Grandma. Mum was saying that the old lady would exhaust us into the grave and outlive us all. I couldn't hear what Dad said. Grandma's room was getting really stinky now. It had always been a bit stinky, but this was more toilety now. It hadn't been irksome before, but it was now. When I went in, she suddenly sat up in bed and said, "Where am I?" I said, "You're here in your room, Grandma." And then she grabbed my arm and she said, "I'm over there. I'm over there." And she pointed to her photo on the wall, of her as a young girl, Emma, in other words. And I said, "Yes, that's right, that's you." And then she pointed to her dressing gown on the back of the door and said, "There, that's me, there I am." And her hand got tighter on me, which hurt. Then she started saying my name over and over again, like, "Henry, Henry, Henry," like that. "Henry, Henry, Henry." And I told her she was hurting me, but she was shouting really loudly now, and she started saying nutty things like, "Put my voice under a walnut tree, Henry, Henry, Henry." That's when Mum came rushing in, already all red and worked up, going, "Henry, what have you done?" Then I got free and ran to the door. It's funny, because then Mum's face changed, and she went over and hugged Grandma quietly and calmed her down. She rocked her like she was 2 years old. When I came out, I saw Dad had been standing at his door listening. He shut it when he saw me. Later, in my room, Mum did this speech where she had this patient, wise voice that she always uses for talking bollocks, where it's like, "When you're older, you'll understand that this is not bollocks." She said that Grandma needed me to let go of her. Like I had to say goodbye, and it would be like permission for her to go. I said I could see what she was up to, and that Mum and Dad and Max and everyone might want her dead, but I wasn't going to help her with her conspiracy.
Colin Firth, what inspired this story?
Don't know. I find it very, very difficult to answer any questions about this. I don't know. It just made it up, came out of my head. There must be a better answer to this. It's a very odd thing. My own grandmother died about 2 months ago, and it was, to some extent, life imitating art rather than the other way around. A story has meant a great deal to me from the beginning.
In this character, your grandmother's a storyteller and tells you stories all the time, though it's much difficult for her to do it toward the end of her life.
Well, I found that interesting too. I think that, you know, I'm interested in the idea that, that one can have this passion for stories, and the grandmother, I feel, is, she calls herself his muse at a certain point because he listens to her stories, and then he recounts these stories to his schoolmates and earns a certain amount of popularity for that. And I feel that wherever one draws inspiration, that is not necessarily going to be an inexhaustible spring. I think that you've often got to go and look for it somewhere else. And I think that when the voice of your muse gets scrambled what happens then? And I was interested in that because I would often find I thought I'd found an answer here. I'd continually through my life I've solved a problem, and then you find that no, you can't continue using that resolution. You've got to go and find it somewhere else. And so I found that the whole business of language and of the loss of the use of clarity of language was very interesting. And I think that the other element was the relationship between the very old and the very young. And I think that it's something that's hugely important. Our society probably doesn't make quite enough of it. We put old people in homes. I think we're rather afraid of seeing what happens to them. I think we have a very, very big taboo in Western society about death. I think it's a taboo that's arguably bigger than sex was to the Victorians.
In the story, the boy has a dream just before his grandmother dies that her dentures are talking. Her dentures, not in her mouth, are talking. And I know several people who've had death dreams or death premonitions that had to do with teeth.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Now, that's interesting because this really was just some wacky thing I made up. So I'd never heard that.
Mm-hmm.
So you're telling me that this has actually come up as a bit of a syndrome.
Well, it kind of rang true to me, I'll say that.
How interesting. I wonder what that is. I don't know whether... I mean, teeth are... I don't know. I would hate to even try to analyze.
All right. So you didn't have a grandmother who was dying when you were young?
No. No, I'm in the extremely fortunate position of having had all four grandparents alive still at the age when I was 34. So they've all gone now.
If this isn't too personal, who was the first person close to you who died?
My mother's father.
And this was just a couple of months ago?
No, that was 6 years ago.
Oh.
But I hadn't experienced any death at all in my family until 34. So one can carry a strange, irrational feeling inside oneself that nobody ever dies in one's family. Of course, you know, intellectually you're waiting for it and you can see people getting older. But until you actually feel it, there's a sense of immortality. And so it was, it was the most enormous blessing in my life that I had these people around me for so long. I had, there have been people of my age, friends, who have died for various reasons. And that experience goes back to childhood. A very close friend of mine died on a motorcycle when we were both teenagers. It's been kind of topsy-turvy. I've lost people who are young, but not so many people who are old.
My guest is Colin Firth. He's now starring in the film Bridget Jones's Diary. His short story is published in the new book, Speaking with the Angel. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Colin Firth. He's now starring in the film Bridget Jones's Diary. When we left off, we were talking about a short story he wrote about the death of a grandmother. Now, I mean, death is something you've had to deal with in movies.
Mm.
Characters die. Characters react to people who die.
Mm-hmm.
I myself have died. Yeah, and you're just in Hamlet where everybody dies.
Yes, that's right.
So when you're, doing a play or a movie in which there is death, do you find that you have to think about death a lot and kind of mentally take yourself to that place in order to get into the right place for the role? Or is that asking too much?
No, it's not asking too much. And I think that one does think about it. I don't think of death as a horrible, morbid subject. I mean, this goes back to this feeling I had of it being a taboo. I think it's not at all. I think that it's actually it can be seen as a possibly, you know, not only reconcilable but creative thing to take on board.
What kind of beliefs about death were you brought up with? You know, we talked earlier about your parents and grandparents. Your grandparents, you had a couple of grandparents who were missionaries. Mm-hmm. Your mother, you described as being more pantheistic, and she wrote a mm-hmm. dissertation recently about religion. And you were exposed to many different religions when you were growing up. What did your parents tell you about death?
Well, I think that what I suppose the views that I'm trying to expound probably originated there. As I said, my father doesn't usually express philosophy very much in that area. He allows doubts to be doubts, and I think I would go along with that, really. I don't think I feel very certain about anything from a philosophical point of view. My mother has a very strong interest in concepts of the afterlife. Again, I don't think she has a fixed view, but she has actually done research into the whole business of, clinical death, the death that takes place on the operating table where people come back again, where she's interviewed a lot of people and she's actually published stuff on that. And I have grown up with an awareness of concepts that death is a transition, that it leads to something else, that it's... I remember being captivated as a child by the idea of the analogy of the caterpillar coming out of the cocoon and becoming a butterfly, and finding out that the Greek word, apparently the ancient Greek word for butterfly, was psyche, and that that somehow it could be a release. And I do love that idea. As I said, I have no certainty. This is not built into a belief or a belief system or
an ideology or anything.
No, not really. But I do find those issues quite fascinating. I don't necessarily know that the most important view of death is about that and how glorious an afterlife might be. But I think that it's the one great inevitability we all face, and I think that facing it can only be a good thing.
While we're talking about death and life, you have a new baby.
That's right.
How's it changing your sense of yourself to be a father?
Well, it's not the first time I'm a father. I've been a father for 10 years.
This is now
the second time, and I would say it's probably talking about my children is not it's not something I like to do in great detail, but I think it's certainly fair to say that I would consider it the biggest and most important change that I've ever gone through. I think it totally gave me a different sense of myself. I think that, there are an awful lot of cliches about this and a sense of priorities and whatever. All that did happen to me. I found it a much wilder experience than I had expected. Many, many years ago, I didn't expect to want children. I didn't want them. I didn't think that was, that was my script. And then, I changed my mind. I didn't have any children by accident. And I was astonished at how much, it gave me a better relationship with myself, I think, and tested me in ways which I didn't expect. I think my view of fatherhood previously had been middle age, slippers, pipe, boredom and death, really. Death in a bad way, just sort of slow death by comfort. I couldn't have been more wrong. I found it the most invigorating and rejuvenating thing that imaginable.
Well, one more thing, and we only have about a minute left. Earlier you read an excerpt of a short story you wrote that Nick Hornby published in a new collection. Do you write a lot? Was this story unusual, or have you been writing?
Writing's been a hobby of mine for years. I enjoy it. As I said, I love storytelling. I read and I like to write and think things up. I've never had a huge ambition to be published, so it has remained a kind of hobby. I sometimes exchange stories with friends. I have a couple of friends who also write a little bit, and it's often been just to Yes, you know, just to appeal to somebody's sense of humor as much as anything else. But yes, I do.
And Nick Hornby knew that you wrote?
Yes. He was encouraging me to do it. He wanted me to, for quite some time, actually. He'd been just giving me a little nudge every so often in the belief that I could come up with something worth publishing. So I owe him a great debt, actually, for making me finally actually put that into action.
Well, Colin Firth, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure.
Colin Firth is now starring in the film Bridget Jones's Diary. His short story is published in the book Speaking with the Angel, edited by Nick Hornby. Coming up, a new reissue of the 1943 cast recording of Rodgers and Hart's A Connecticut Yankee. This is Fresh Air. One of the rarest of all original Broadway cast recordings is the 1943 revival of Rodgers and Hart's A Connecticut Yankee. It's been commercially unavailable since the days of the 78. The masters were thought to be lost, but a master recording was found a couple of years ago, and Decca Broadway has just reissued the album. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
One of the happiest inspirations Richard Rodgers and Lawrence Hart ever had was to turn Mark Twain's comic novel, A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, into a Broadway show. Twain's cheeky, cheek-by-jowl juxtaposition of Arthurian legend and contemporary America played to the special strengths of Rodgers and Hart. In their witty blending of musical and linguistic styles, formality and dignity show up the triviality and silliness of contemporary lingo, and jazzy slang, in turn, punctures inflated highbrow pretentiousness.
Thou swell, thou witty, thou sweet, thou grand, wouldst kiss me pretty, wouldst hold my hand. For thine eyes are cute to what they do to me. Hear me holler, I choose a sweet Lollapalooza in thee. I'd feel so rich in a heart for two rooms and kitchen, I'm sure would do. Give me just a plot of not a lot of land, and thou swell, thou witty, thou grand.
Back in lighthearted 1927, before the Wall Street bust, a Connecticut Yankee became one of Rodgers and Hart's biggest hits. In 1943, it seemed like a great idea to revive a show in which the hero saves his hide through particularly American ingenuity. Book writer Herbert Fields updated the story a little. Hart added some of his cleverest new lyrics, and Rodgers added some tunes in the more sentimental style he had just embarked on with his new partner, Oscar Hammerstein II, in Oklahoma, the homespun musical that marked a big turning away from the glorious era of sophistication and wit that Hart embodied. It's a perfect emblem of this transition that Rodgers and Hart's last show and Rodgers and Hammerstein's first were running on Broadway at the same time. The cast of Connecticut Yankee included matinee idol Dick Foran and, to use her own word in the show, the hoydenish Vera Ellen, a pretty dancer with an irresistible tomboy croak. I think Hollywood later kept her from becoming a bigger star by having trained singers dub her voice. Here's her real voice in the teasing I Feel at Home with You.
I used to be a hoyden. Boys were my hate. I was a lady hermit. I couldn't be annoyed in making a date. Silly, I would term it. You seem so daring, my heart grew frail. Now I like wearing my coat of mail.
The biggest star of a Connecticut Yankee was Broadway legend Vivian Siegel, who 4 years earlier created the role of the wealthy society lady who becomes bewitched, bothered, and bewildered by her low-life lover in Rodgers and Hart's most worldly-wise musical, Pal Joey. This devilish catalog song for Siegel, as the bloodthirsty Morgan Le Fay, was probably, and fittingly, Hart's very last lyric.
I married many men, a ton of them, and yet I was untrue to none of them, because I bumped off every one of them to keep my love alive. Sir Paul was frail, he looked a wreck to me. At night he was a horse's neck to me. So I performed an appendectomy to keep my love alive. Sir Thomas had insomnia. He couldn't sleep at night. I bought a little arsenic. He's sleeping now, all right. Sir Roger played the harp. I cussed the thing. I crowned him with his harp to bust the thing. And now he plays where harps are just the thing to keep my love alive, to keep my love alive.
In some ways, so many of these classic theater songs are about language itself. How playing with words can be exhilarating, touching, even sexy. One of my favorite songs, It Never Entered My Mind, is included on the new Connecticut Yankee CD along with several covers of songs from two other early 1940s Rodgers and Hart musicals. It's sung here by Shirley Ross, who is best known for introducing Thanks for the Memory with Bob Hope.
Once I laughed when I heard you say that I'd be playing solitaire. uneasy in my easy chair. It never entered my mind. Once you told me I was mistaken, that I'd awaken with the sun and order orange juice for one. It never entered my mind. You have what I lack myself, and now I even have to scratch my back myself.
Uneasy in my easy chair. Orange juice for one. Roger's insinuating anthem caresses Hart's touchingly ironic lyric, which I think stands up to any love poem written in the last century.
Lloyd Schwartz is director of the Creative Writing Program at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix.
Thou swear, thou witty, thou sweet, thou grand.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Monique Nazareth, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I feel so rich in a heart for two.
Two rooms and kitchen I sure would do.
Give me just a plot of not a lot of land, and I'll swear the witty.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Random House Incorporated's Crown Publishing Group Division, publishers of The Elements of Journalism, What News People Should Know and the Public Should Expect, by Bill Kovich and Tom Rosenstiel. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
For the last 15 years, a team of scientists has studied a group of over 600 nuns as they move through the aging process. On the next Fresh Air, the head of the team, Dr. David Snowden, tells us what the nun study reveals about the causes and symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.